afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the FCC, and sorry to disturb what sounds like a very jovial lunch. Delighted to have a full house here today on what is a synergy, once again, of wig and pen in our main dining room. Now, just before we get started, I'd like to point out a few events that we have upcoming at the club. This week, we have Matthew Marsh coming to speak on the death of Formula One racing. On Saturday this week, we have a very exciting and comprehensive day on journalism at the club. We have events running from morning through the afternoon on different aspects of the industry and working in the industry. So it would be great if you could attend that. And also coming this month, we have Regina Ip coming to speak, and we have the film 10 Years, which we will also broadcast here at the club. So please keep a lookout on the website for events upcoming. Now, it's rare to start an event here at the club with a summary of words that have already been spoken here, but given the series of speakers we've had on legal world here in Hong Kong, I'd just like to recap a few points that we've heard recently. Last week, we had Wang Jianmin, a member of China's Basic Law Committee, and he said that any call for independence in Hong Kong was breaking the law and that secession advocates could face prosecution here in Hong Kong. Last December, we had Henry Litton come to speak at the club, a retired final court of appeal judge, and he warned here that he thought that Hong Kong was sleepwalking towards 2047. He also said he thought judicial reviews were being, quote, misused, with some judgments so obscure that no one could understand them. Well, now I'm very pleased that we have Justice Bokhari here to speak today on the topic of the challenge facing Hong Kong courts. Many of you here in Hong Kong are very familiar with his distinguished legal career. He joined the judiciary as a judge in the High Court in 1989. From 1997 to 2012, he served as a permanent judge of the Court of Final Appeal. He did confess to me that he's very interested in journalism. He's written several books since retiring from the court, so maybe we have much more to see from him in newspapers and websites. But for now, I'm delighted to introduce Justice Bokhari.
Everywhere in the world, courts are duty-bound to deliver effective justice according to law. This means, first of all, that the law must be at least essentially just. And people should be able to understand the law, if necessary, with the assistance of legal advice. Unavoidably, this will leave the most difficult points of law to be resolved by the judicial process, sometimes continuing all the way up to the court of last resort. The issues to be resolved, maybe as to the law, as to the facts, or as to both. Whatever may be the issues to be resolved by adjudication, the process should be affordable and free from undue delay. The decisions must be intelligible, especially in, although by no means only in, a common law system involving a doctrine of judicial precedent, and where broad issues of public law are involved, what has to be decided, what has been decided, and why it was so decided, should be readily apparent from the judgment. When the United States Supreme Court were deliberating on its judgment in the desegregation case of Brown, the Board of Education, Chief Justice Warren insisted that there be a single judgment, that it be perfectly clear, that it be intelligible to any person reading it, and that it be short enough for every major American newspaper to publish it in full the following morning. And that's exactly what happened. Always, the courts must be fearlessly independent. Otherwise, all will be a mere mockery. All obstacles in the way of these requirements must be overcome. Seeing to that is a challenge which courts everywhere in the world face now, can expect to face in the future, and must always be vigilantly prepared to meet. Mr. Justice Lytton spoke here recently. He and I are the best of friends. On some things, we agree completely. On other things, principally on human rights, we profoundly disagree. What we disagree on has never stood in the way of our working together on things within our area of agreement. It has never impaired our friendship, nor has it ever diminished my respect for him. He is a firm believer in expedition, brevity, and clarity. I too believe in these things. Following him at a respectful distance, of course. I regard him as a master communicator. There may, however, be a number of things which he does not consider worth communicating, while I consider them important to communicate. Among these things appear to be the reasons to be given when dismissing a public law claim, if one dismisses it, or refusing leave to bring such a claim, if one refuses such leave. Perhaps he considers me excessively patient with such claims, while I, respectfully of course, think that he should be more patient with them. We also differ on the value of cases decided in other parts of the world or in academic writings emanating from other parts of the world. When he was here, he criticized a particular citation in the Court of Final Appeal of a foreign case. It was I, although he was far too polite to say that it was I, who cited that case. And just this morning, I was in the High Court Library reading an article in the Irish Law Times about the alleviation in Nigeria of poverty among women through redistributive land reform. Some of it had relevance to Hong Kong, and one point was highly relevant to Hong Kong. After all, and here I quote the highest possible source, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt underlined that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights set a common standard of achievement for all peoples of all nations. I think there's also a difference between Mr. Justice Lytton's view and mine as to what, if any, regard is to be paid to the feelings of the losing party. He is, of course, right that the primary interests of litigants lie in whether they win or lose. But that does not, in my view, mean that the reasons for the result are of no interest to the losing party. And of course, those reasons can be of very great importance to a proper understanding of the law. Perhaps the public would benefit very considerably if Mr. Justice Lytton gives further thought to the points which I seek to make, while, and here there's no doubt, the rest of us would benefit the public if we endeavored to learn more from him about clear and concise communication and the speedy resolution of cases. Thus far, the challenges of which I have spoken, present and future, are ones which the Hong Kong courts face in common with all other courts everywhere in the world, if those courts are worthy of the name. But it is not unknown for a judiciary to have a special task which it does not share with judiciaries elsewhere in the world. The Hong Kong courts have such a task. It is to do their part, and it is a major part, in making the one country, two systems principle work. In carrying out this special task, the Hong Kong courts have faced and are facing a number of grave challenges. And we must be prepared for those challenges to increase. Mr. Justice Lytton has in effect raised a question as to whether our judges are awake to the challenges which they now face and will face in the future. He does not allege that they are not, and merely asks if they are. Well, my answer is that we are all awake to those challenges. The one country, two systems principle, declared in the Sino-British Joint Declaration in Hong Kong, and in the preamble to our constitution, the basic law, is the bedrock on which the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region is built. Under this principle, Hong Kong, as an inalienable part of China, is authorized to exercise a high degree of autonomy, and the handover way of life in Hong Kong is to remain unchanged for 50 years from the 1st of July 1997. What will happen after those 50 years? Voices, which perhaps can be said to be louder than they are numerous, have recently been heard to propose, or at least raise the question of independence. As a great judge, Lord Justice Scruton, has pointed out, you really believe in freedom of speech if you allow it to those whose opinions seem to you wrong and even dangerous. That duly noted, I would stress that my own view is that the preservation of our way of life beyond 2047 is to be pursued through an extension of the one country, two systems principle. And that involves our courts doing everything within their province to make the one country, two systems principle work. In the performance of this task, as in the performance of all the other tasks, our courts must remain and be seen to remain impartial and outside politics. This does not mean ignoring the social context. Of late, we have witnessed growing discontent and even growing fear in Hong Kong. As to fear, I have nothing to add to what others have said, are saying, and doubtless will continue to say here and abroad on the matter of the booksellers. Insofar as discontent has led to civil disobedience, I must avoid saying anything that might prejudice pending cases. I say no more about civil disobedience than that there are studies on the subject which everybody can consult if they wish. Insofar as discontent has led to violence in the streets, I might likewise say nothing that might prejudice pending cases. Does not prevent anybody from saying, as I do say, that violence is not the way. Insofar as discontent has led to calls for independence or consideration of independence, I've already indicated that I place my faith in the one country, two systems principle, but you've also heard what I said about free speech. I make no attempt to identify all the sources of discontent to which I've referred, but I do say that in a democracy, it is principally through the democratic process that people pursue their aspirations. And the intention of our constitution is that Hong Kong shall become a democracy. The ultimate aim, Article 68 of the Basic Law provides, is the election of all members of the Legislative Council by universal suffrage. Article 45 of the Basic Law provides that the ultimate aim is the selection of the chief executive by universal suffrage in accordance upon the nomination of a broadly representative nominating committee in accordance with democratic process. As I see it, the nominating committee must be meant faithfully to serve the ultimate aim of universal suffrage. And this informs how the committee should be formed and how it is to function. A lot of people would prefer that the provision for nomination were not there. I'm one of those persons, but it is there. And I see no prospect of it going away. So we have to try and ensure that the nominating committee does not do anything that will undermine universal suffrage as it is understood under a one country, two systems principle. If a halt along the path to democracy has tipped social harmony beyond the point of equilibrium, it may be that restarting along that path will not restore the equilibrium instantly or even soon. This makes an early restart all the more important. Until such restart, indeed until the attainment of fully evolved democracy here, the task of the Hong Kong courts will be especially challenging. Principally, our courts will meet this challenge by delivering all other human rights apart from democracy. These other human rights are socioeconomic as well as civil and political. Our courts will deliver these rights by focusing on our own circumstances while at the same time making good use of the lessons of other jurisdictions' experience. Throughout, let us not forget the statement of the United States Supreme Court in Westbury and Sanders that other rights, even the most basic, are illusory if the right to vote is undermined. I believe that through all difficulties, present and future, each and every one of our judges, present and future, will do her or his duty as she or he has the light to see that duty. May that light always prove to be sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Justice Bokhari. We have time for Q&A, so if you would raise your hand, do give us your name and organization if you're with one. And let's start right up here up front. We'll bring a microphone to you.
I'm Dennis Kwok, a member of the Legislative Council representing the legal profession. Thank you, Judge, for that talk. It's always good to hear you speak. There's talk in the community about the right to self-determination, Hong Kong people deciding the future, especially after 2047. You mentioned about human rights. Some people see that as a human right, and it's certainly mentioned in Article 1 of the ICCPR, albeit it may be an aspiration more than a concrete legal right at the moment. I just want to hear what you think about the right to self-determination and about Hong Kong's future. Thank you.
In the international context, the right to self-determination sometimes encompasses the formation of an independent state. It does not always mean that, because what defines a people with the right of self-determination as a group can be problematical, and secessionism throughout the world does emerge from time to time. In terms of practicalities, and even a devotee of human rights is entitled to have regard to the practicalities, I think that the self-determination that we would have in Hong Kong would be to preserve our way of life, evolving according to the principles of freedom and justice that we believe in, and welcoming in our midst other people from other parts of the world. And I see the path in that regard under the extension of the one country, two systems principle. Some people would not agree with me that there should be a continuation of two systems. Some people wish to say there should be two countries. I recognize their right to say so. My own view is as I have stated. Thank you.
Questions? Right over here, please.
Hello, Charles Kroftakis of BTRG. This is slightly unexpected, perhaps, but it's related to the current democratic situation in both Hong Kong and in Britain. What do you think about the contradiction of Hong Kongers being thirsty for democracy at the same time as the British public has a choice now of either being independent or giving away its democracy to Europe?
Well, I suppose I don't actually know enough about the situation about an exit from Europe to comment very sensibly on that in itself. I am a British citizen. If I was there, I'd be able to vote in it, and I think I would vote in remaining within the Union myself. As far as the exit from Europe is concerned, that would not affect the integrity of the United Kingdom as a sovereign state. Scottish independence would, but then historically, Scotland had been a country, and the English approached the Act of Union, and the Scottish one may be different. In Hong Kong, people want democracy, and insofar as there is a call for independence, it seems to me to spring from frustration over the lack of progress in the attainment of democracy. And while democracy is high enough a principle to favor it in principle, I think the people of Hong Kong want democracy for the purpose of effecting change to the lives of the vast majority. I can see the think bubbles coming out of some people's head that my own financial position wouldn't be improved by democracy in Hong Kong. I'm not so stupid I don't know that. But in all decency, I put my heart and soul in support of democracy.
In the front here, Martin Lee.
another word for democracy.
Quite frankly, Martin Lee, former member of the legislature, frankly, I don't understand why the British government or Chancellor Merkel has not suggested one Europe, two systems. Then I don't see any necessity for Britain to get out. My question, Judge, is this. Do you think that the rule of law in Hong Kong and the independence of the judiciary in Hong Kong can last without democracy?
When you said judge, were you talking to me, Martin? I always thought you called me Kemi.
You're still a non-permanent judge.
Well, you know, I suppose a judiciary can remain independent even in the absence of democracy. But that doesn't mean to say that the judiciary would be effective in preserving the Hong Kong lifestyle in the absence of democracy. So yes, I suppose the judges could be independent, but an independent judge can be an ineffective one. I agree with you that if you have a situation which is undemocratic going on and on and on, then all the things which were second nature to you and I may recede into the background to the point where judicial independence is eroded. But I rather think that won't happen. But what I do wish to emphasize is the mere fact that the judge is independent doesn't mean that all will be well. All will definitely not be well if the judge is not independent, that's for sure. But just because the judge is independent doesn't mean that the legal system will deliver on all the things that they should deliver.
Can I just follow up on that question with a question about erosion or receding? Do you feel that in the current situation that we are in with one country, two system, and not full democracy, that we are starting to see signs of judiciary independence receding or some sort of erosion within the system? Have you seen any little signs over the last few years?
Now, insofar as the integrity of the judges are concerned, I've seen no such sign. And I would be very pleased if the general public would say that if there were any such signs to see, he would have seen it. But they may think that I've missed the signs. They may think that I myself am not independent. The system has to be such that people believe in it, even if they've never met a single one of our judges. When I'm asked about the integrity of the judges, there comes before my consciousness the faces of my colleagues whom I trust. But no system can function if you don't trust your judges unless you know them. The institutions should be such that people trust them. And if we have a lack of democracy so that one says that the political branches of government are not constituted in any democratic way, then people would say, having regard to the fact that they're involved in the appointment of judges, insofar as they are involved in the funding of the judiciary, sooner or later there will be problems, and that's perfectly legitimate. So we cannot be complacent about these matters. My ability to answer these questions is somewhat affected by the fact that whenever I'm asked anything, I always think of my colleagues, of whom I have such a high opinion. Now, of course, quite apart from the judges doing what is right when they're allowed to do it, there can be a question of it being taken away from the judges to do at all, such as excessive use of reinterpretations or interpretations by the standing committee. There is room for this within our constitution setup. There is an interpretive rule for the standing committee, although I have never seen a situation where I thought it was really necessary to exercise it. But if it's ever exercised with something which really begins to look like institutionalized excess, then the fact that the judges will act independently when they're allowed to decide will become somewhat hollow, because there will be important cases where they're not left to decide.
We have a question right here.
Thank you. My name's Paul Christensen. You talked about the nominating committee and that it should be broadly representative under the terms of the Basic Law. I think we can all agree that it isn't broadly representative as it's currently constituted. Clearly, one of the main areas it's missing is the poor people. The chief executive sees this as a good thing. The rest of us probably see that as a bad thing. So my question really is, do you see a realistic route getting from where we are to actually achieving a broadly representative nominating committee? And if so, roughly what would that route look like?
Well, you know, I think that if you limit the number of persons in the nominating committee, but they themselves are elected to their position, then the argument shifts itself to the electoral arrangements. And it will not be perfect, but it might be acceptable. Now, you see, what may be broadly representative for the selection of a chief executive by a committee, which is manifestly not universal suffrage, which is an ultimate aim lying further in the future, is one thing. But just because a committee is broadly representative for that very limited purpose doesn't mean to say that it would be broadly representative for the purpose of universal suffrage, because now you're talking about the highest possible representation imaginable within the system. And one can say, without necessarily criticizing the committee as constituted for a selection committee, that broadly representative must mean something different for the nominating committee, which is now to serve the aim of universal suffrage as a thing which has arrived and not a thing which lies in the future. You know, there are many times when I think about these problems, and I have enjoyed nothing better, apart from spending time with my grandchildren, than talking to law students. But of late, I've become increasingly uncomfortable in talking to them. I do not wish to be unduly pessimistic, but to be optimistic is not the easiest thing in the world. Yet I say that Hong Kong has solved so many problems in the past that we might solve this one as well. Anyway, I'll be here as long as I live. I'll be even here on the 1st of July, 2047, as a 99-year-old man.
Well, before we get to thinking about those dates, we have one last question from Cliff before I'm afraid we'll have to break up.
Mr. Justice Bukhari, 2012, on your retirement as a permanent judge of the Court of Final Appeal, you warned that storm clouds were gathering over Hong Kong's legal system. I wonder, are they still gathering? Has the storm passed? What's your weather forecast?
Do you know, I think that my fears have been realized, much as I wish that they were not. There are very serious problems now. But what I would like to emphasize is that I said it from the judicial bench. And I said it for a purpose. And I said that I said it for a purpose of giving people faith in judiciary. I said in terms that if the storm broke, the judiciary would stand in that storm. Now, if I painted a rosy picture and then things turned out every bit as difficult as they now are, and I said everything would be all right, then I think it would be rather hollow. But I said then that I feared problems, but that the judiciary would stand up amid those problems. And I still say the judiciary will stand up. And I hope for that reason that my words carry some weight.
I'm afraid we've just gone 2 o'clock, so we're going to have to leave it on that note. Thank you very much, Mr. Justice Bukhari. We do have a small gift from the clock. We hope you'll wear it and come to join us again. And thank you very much to everyone for coming today. We have books on display and for sale up front, and I think there's more time for discussion beyond the lunch. Thank you very much.